Thank you very much, Stan. I feel honored to have been asked to speak to you tonight, friends and guests of the Philadelphia Society. Since this is a bilingual meeting, as Stan explained, I want to tell you about a little confusion I had today when I was looking at the television. I understood from the person that was speaking that these people that were marching to Washington were making a pilgrimage. But when I read it, it said a pilgrimage. And a little later on, it said, talking about the astronauts that were flying around the world, it said that an astronaut got out to inspect the satellite, the capsule, and what was written down said he got out to expect the capsule. So I was very confused about all the news because I was trying to read and listen at the same time, which reminded me of when the Washington Post started to publish something in Spanish. They had some ladies do checking the translator, and I happen to have a sister-in-law that works for the World Bank, and she was she was moonlighting correcting these translations, and one of the best ones that she told me about was during the Desert War, there was a reported that the shot was a near miss, and the machine translated it as almost a señorita, because I think Stan exaggerated a little bit when he said that at the Marroquin University they have to read the works of von Mises. No, they have to read a few pages because, as we know, it's very difficult. But they do have to become familiar with that and with Hayek and the great minds of the philosophy of freedom. Now, to get onto my subject, which it won't be very long, I believe that it is now recognized that Latin America has never given capitalism a chance. South and Central America have suffered and lived under what Adam Smith condemned as mercantilism, or the mercantile system that he called, inherited from Spain and Portugal since the colonial days. With few exceptional decades of last century and the beginning of this century, when Argentina became one of the most developed countries in the world in terms of income per capita, and the other countries that had liberalized their economies were not far behind. Those few decades were followed by a combination and succession of unfortunate events that dominated most of the century. And Latin America abandoned the successful capitalistic policies that had been that had just started, and reverted to mercantilism under one name or another, sometimes under elected governments and sometimes under dictatorships. Then came the Great Depression, World War II, and Keynes, with his macroeconomic tinkering, the United Nations, and the Economic Commission in Latin America, providing prestigious auspices to interventionists and the so-called scientific economic planning. The popular theories at the time were, among others, dependency theory, the permanent deterioration of terms of trade, import substitution, inflation, and the Phillips curve, etc. The World Bank and the IMF financed aggrandizement of government while contributing to the paradise for rent seekers. The U.S. increased its government-to-government economic assistance, which again fostered the prominence of governments in economic affairs. Then in 1961 came the big push for more statism and redistributive policies with the creation of the Agency for International Development. As Paul Craig Roberts and Karen Lafayette point out in their recent excellent book, The Capitalist Revolution in Latin America, I quote, "The government failures in Latin America were so great that they were acknowledged by the international organizations that financed the failed experiment with public-directed economic development. Contrary to intentions, all of that assistance helped prevent the adoption of free, open market economies, and thus contributed to the postponement of the corrections that are now taking place, following the successful example that Chile began in the middle 70s without aid and without the World Bank. Please note that Chile did it while it was considered a pariah by the community of developed nations, who did their best to sabotage their successful efforts. Incidentally, this tells us about how unimportant it is that to have the blessing of the community of nations, for in spite of their hostility, Chile stuck to its free market policies and became an example to the rest of the world. When the world was going through the Cold War, the Soviet Empire, in order to subvert governments friendly to the United States, was intent on providing economic and logistical support for revolutionaries such as Castro, the Montoneros, the Sandinistas, etc. Today, as their sources of foreign support are dying out, the revolutionary movements are crumbling unless they have another source of income, like in Peru and Colombia, where the drug policies of the United States make it possible to maintain private armies. Last but not least, the universities were taken over, first by governments and then by socialists and interventionists, when not outright communists. They have given intellectual support and created a very socialistic culture in the professional class, the lasting effects of which we shall suffer for a long time. It is no coincidence that today our biggest challenge is to change the culture of the inept and corrupt judiciaries infested by lawyers trained in those universities. The economic price of these recurrent and constant policy failures was, of course, poverty. The political price was democratic representative governments. I mean, the loss of democracy. The general discontent with the results with those in power created the climate and opportunities for revolutions and dictatorships. That's why coup d'etats were always so popular. Fortunately, the future looks brighter. As Roberts and Lafayette point out in their book, I quote, "The region is at last shedding the cultural attitude hostile to commerce, trade, and work that made it socially more acceptable to court privilege and peddle influence than to compete in the markets." Unquote. The nature of the solutions to our problems has changed, and not surprisingly, the solutions being adopted are the same in the countries of the developed world of Europe and ex-socialist countries. These policies, as you all know, are more open economies, flexibilized labor legislation, foster competitiveness, leave the direction mainly to market forces, privatize government enterprises, stabilize currencies, reduce deficits, etc. Why, when I mention these remedies, we could be talking of Germany, France, even the United States. In other words, the problems of Latin America today are no longer peculiar to the region, but more global. Thus, our countries are in the process of rationalizing our economic and fiscal legislation to be more competitive, aware that the opportunities for capital investment are more and more international and not confined to the developed countries. Latin America, following Asia, seems on the way to becoming one of the great growth areas of the future. And like Asia, the process will be tenuous and erratic because it is not based on principles, but on pragmatism. Notwithstanding, this is a win-win process from which all rich and poor countries will derive benefits. We must be on guard against isolationists in our midst, as well as the good intention interventionists in the international meddlesome class. I refer to the intrusive international aid lobbies, the World Bank, the IMF, and the governments that dispense funds conditioned on the adoption of their politically correct recommendations. Hopefully, countries like the Scandinavians, France, and Germany will find it harder to justify their largesse in view of their own present economic problems and the fact that the left-wing ideological recipients of their assistance are dwindling. They normally do not lend a hand to those on the right. On the other hand, the assistance of the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, and the US Foreign Aid Department, they're going to be in business for a long time. I don't expect them to disappear in the near future. Again, fortunately, in spite of some persistent hang-ups, their policies are no longer totally hostile to the market. The economic model which is now being promoted by these international development agencies is not the open market economy. It is the regulated market. What Rupert Murdoch, you know who I'm talking about, called neo-socialism in a recent article in National Review, and which Mr. Tarnowski, correcting him in the following issue, claims that it would be more appropriate to call him neo-fascism. And the argument is that socialism is, by definition, the ownership of the means of production by the government, and neo-fascism is that the government lets the private sector own the property, but they must do what the government regulations say. So they, in fact, own the businesses, but not in the formal way. So that's why he suggests we call it neo-fascism. And the political role model being promoted is the politically correct version of the US democracy with emphasis on welfare that we cannot afford. Aid officials recommend free trade, but not unilateral removal of import restrictions, for instance, which, considering that small countries do not have sufficient internal competition to force their economies to allocate resources efficiently, they need more than the large countries the pressure of international competition. They do not recommend free trade as a recognition of property rights, where there is an exchange between owners of something that happen to live in different countries. They recommend regulation. They recommend privatization, and they come in with regulation immediately. When Congress in Guatemala was passing a law getting rid of all intervention in the electricity market, the AID officials and the World Bank insisted on introducing a clause in the law at the last minute, which said that Congress will pass a law 90 days from now regulating the electric power business. Here they were liberating it And at the same time, they were putting a clause saying that they had to 90 days regulated. And I have a copy on AID stationery of the first draft of the regulatory law. Now, they apparently are not aware of what George Stigler used to say, that the regulators would eventually regulate, will eventually control the regulators, which they already do, and which they will do more and more. Now, I could cite many examples of their economic advice, a halfway house to the market economy, but I would end with a few words about the political and fiscal advice their officials are giving. Of course, they're giving it accompanied by grants and loans. They continue to insist on government controls, citing so-called market failures. Their model of managed trade, of course, appeals to privileged classes and other rent seekers who have exploited government privileges over the years, to the nihilists and socialists who still lament the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and to labor unions who are united attacking the so-called neoliberals who want to free the economy. They have many people promoting the market, but as Leonard Reed used to say at the Foundation for Economic Education, they leak at the seams. The political role model being promoted is the image of what the politically correct historians would have us believe about the U.S., about how the U.S. came to be the great country it is. Their policy is driven by egalitarianism. They represent the U.S. to us as a country committed to equality of results from the time of its origin, more than to equality before the law. Whereas we learned from reading, for example, Basic Symbols by Wilmore Kendall and George Carey, the idea was, from the beginning, from the Mayflower, to entrust the government to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinances, acts, etc. And at the very time when the progressive income tax is being reconsidered here in the United States, international development agencies recommend more to us, and more redistribution, and more equality of results via income tax and social expenses. Evidently, they do not appreciate the urgent need of proper incentives to capital formation, nor its social welfare effects. I mean, of capital formation. They also don't appreciate the detrimental effects of the social policies they're recommending, as pointed out by George Gilder and others here in the United States. And as a matter of fact, most of the income tax laws in Latin America were passed at the urging of the U.S. government as a condition to receiving foreign aid. I am persuaded by those authors that the quest for equality of results in the United States is, historically speaking, recent. And it did not form part of the Constitution or the constitutions that preceded the existing Constitution, nor of any of the other documents except at the time you get to the Declaration of Independence, about which there is controversy about what the word equal meant, and whether it referred to equal in general or equality of every man as a unique individual person. Now, I am persuaded by the authors that believe that it did not mean equality of results nor equality of every individual human being, which is what is being sold to us now. Further, I am of the opinion that many of these philosophies that are being expressed to us of government organization and your constitution work in a democratic federal democracy do not work necessarily in a politically centralized democratic country. I'm inclined to believe that the federation of largely sovereign states jealous of their autonomy is a more effective balance of power than the tripartite division of government powers. That much I believe in federation, but I think it's even a stronger balance of power. What I'm trying to say is that the states' rights, I believe, have been a more powerful powerful influence in keeping government down than the division of government in three powers. And, for example, I would not be surprised if federalism were more effective in checking local pressure groups than antitrust legislation. Now that there's more and more centralization of power at the expense of the states, with the federal government involved in everything, Washington has become a city of lobbyists, much as in Latin America, where success depends not on serving consumers in the market, but in the lobbies exchanging favors. It is no longer a model to be recommended, and much less to copy. The Constitution of the United States, which was principally, in my interpretation, an instrument to govern relations between states, is perhaps not as good a model as it is generally considered for a non-federal government. It is true that it has been copied all over the world, but as far as I know, only in Switzerland did it perdure. Maybe a better model to export would be the Constitution of Virginia or Massachusetts. It seems that the international advisors are not even aware of the fact that international organizations that financed the failed experiment, It seems that the international advisors are not even aware of the fact that the word democracy does not appear in the founding documents of the United States. My reading of history is that the character of the U.S. model was, until this century, with few exceptions, that of a representative republic of individual responsibility and self-reliance and religious people, and not of the dependence on the state and the government. Americans overwhelmingly were proud and not ashamed of extraordinary financial success, rejected robbing Peter to help Paul, and were mind your own business types, but yet cosmopolitan. During the rise of the US to a great power until World War II, the ratio of government revenue to GNP was much less than 10% in peacetime. The political advisors to our countries, in this sense, are not typical Americans. They dogmatically recommend raising taxes in order to have a better, meaning higher, ratio between revenues and GNP, as if this magic proportion had a meaning of its own. I have dwelled on the influence of aid dispensing agencies for a few minutes because of their disproportionate influence in making policy in Latin America. I am sure that their advice would be considered improper intervention if it were not accompanied by generous financial assistance. I am also sure that in the US, such intromission in local affairs would be considered improper, if not illegal. However, the mistakes of Latin America are definitely our own, and not due to these international agencies, nor indeed could we, because we could certainly send them packing. It is totally our responsibility. But, you know, politicians are politicians. They like foreign taxpayers' money and frequent trips abroad. And so to keep the monies coming, they uncritically comply. I do not want to imply that the officials in charge of financial aid are self-serving, but they are crusaders, and I am not sure which is worse. In the context of macroeconomic figures, the amount of the grants are not very large, but at the margin, they are very effective. We must resign ourselves to the fact that we don't live in a perfect world. Latin America is going the right way. Many times it is going the right way for the wrong reason, but it is going in the right way. It gives us a breathing spell of a few years, perhaps. It promises more freedom and prosperity than in the past. And this prosperity will also be good for the U.S. and the world, because in a freer world, we're all better off when our neighbors are better off. Thank you.
Thank you, Musso. Could not have had a better keynote. Let me just add, if I might, sort of a footnote to what you said. Your reading of the American experiment and the misreading that you were dealing with, all of that is very much in the mix up here. And that same misreading of our past in the United States is taught to our own people. So it isn't just for export. We have this at home also. Your interpretation, on my view, is exactly correct. And I might add, if you look at the phraseology, the declaration, quite apart from the other documents to which you correctly referred, the equality talked about is equality in the sight of God. We're equal because we're all God's children. That's what that says, endowed by their creator, created equal. That notion of equality and equality under the law, which you talked about, is not only different from equality of results, it is the exact antithesis of the equality of results, because if you're going to take people who have different aptitudes, interests, energies, abilities, whatever you want to call it, which is true of every human being on earth. We're all different in some way in all of those categories. And make them all come out at the same result, you have to treat them under the law unequally. And we see that here in the United States in so-called affirmative action programs, in which to get a numerical ratio established in our colleges and universities or in hiring policies, you have to treat people in very different ways. You have to have different standards. And that is, of course, a scandal of our politics that is. It was eagerly awaited by the Washington Post. And the manifesto will say, in essence, that we cannot rest in America, United States, as long as 50% of the population is still below the median. Relevant to them. Now, enough of that. I'm told here, my instructions say, repeat important announcements. So I will do so. First of all, if you have not registered yet, we can accommodate you in that regard after this meeting is concluded. Julie, where is Julie? Probably outside organizing transportation, I imagine. Again, the Calero dinner, please sign up for that at your earliest possible opportunity. There will be a continental breakfast tomorrow morning at 7:30 a.m. for early risers. I regret I will not be able to join you for that. I have a prior commitment. Our first general session tomorrow will begin at 9 a.m. in the Perot Room. Unfortunately, Ross Perot will not be able to be with us, but we will be in his room. There is, after we return to the hotel this evening, a hospitality suite being sponsored by our friends from the Landrum Society, and it will be in room 782 of the hotel which we are staying. I believe I followed my instructions to the letter, and if I have, hearing no objection, these proceedings are about to be adjourned. The shuttle back to the St. Anthony will be that way, I guess, the same way we came in. Thank you all. We are adjourned.